opened, you know, the behavior of people in opening was just as if COVID didn't exist.
As COVID-19 cases in Florida continue to rise, human behavior could be our biggest challenge.
We are actually, you know, going to be fining people just like you would if you're not wearing your seatbelt, just like you would if you run a red light or run a stop sign.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway for Thursday, July 2nd, we speak with Miami Mayor Francis Suarez on his attempts to mitigate the spread of the virus. Then, how changes by the Trump administration are placing the independence of international U.S. media at risk.
With literally one set of acts, you know, the Trump administration has very badly damaged that trust. And this could have political significance in all kinds of ways that we haven't even thought of yet.
All that and more. Let's do this. All this week, we've been checking in on emerging hotspots for the COVID-19 crisis, from Texas to New Mexico and Arizona. And today we go to one of the hardest hit states, Florida, where differences between Governor Ron DeSantis and local leaders are leaving Floridians stuck in the middle. On Wednesday, Florida recorded 6,500 new cases of COVID-19, bringing the state's total to nearly 160,000 cases since the pandemic began. More than 3,500 people have died. But Governor DeSantis has refused to take any more steps to close businesses or put in place any stay-at-home orders to mitigate the spread of the coronavirus. The city of Miami, however, has begun taking emergency measures to slow the spread of the virus by requiring all residents to wear masks or face coverings. The city also enacted a mandatory 10-day closure for businesses that don't comply with the emergency guidelines. So we decided to talk to
Francis Suarez, the mayor of the city of Miami.
And I asked Mayor Suarez to tell me what the latest was on the virus in his city.
Well, we just came off a very difficult week where we sort of shattered records, not in a good way. You know, our high water mark in late March, early April, before we implemented a stay-at-home order was 533 cases. This week we had one day where we had 1,500 cases, and we had another day where we had 2,100 cases. So you're talking about a 3x and a 4x in new cases from the high water mark when we implemented a stay-at-home order in late March, early April. So, you know, we are obviously extremely concerned about that. We're seeing our hospitalizations go up, our ventilators go up, our ICUs go up. And that's also a concern because, you know, everything that we've seen in terms of this disease, this virus, indicates that the death rate is somewhere in the vicinity of 3% of those that contract it. But if our hospitals are stressed, that death rate can climb to 8%, 12%, 14%. As it has in other parts of the world, in Italy and Spain, and in other parts of the U.S., in New York, with an 8%, you know, mortality rate. So, you know, it's a major concern. We are taking some steps to address that, and we're hopeful that, you know, we're able to get control of it.
Mayor, you mentioned New York, and I was here during the peak of the crisis when we were the epicenter of this pandemic back earlier this spring. The mood in New York City around that time was one of just fear, concern, and constant images coming out of hospitals and ICUs and emergency rooms that were at capacity in certain neighborhoods. What is the mood in Miami right now? Are Floridians aware of the extent of the rise that is happening around them?
I don't think the mood is as apoplectic as it was in New York during that time, because we're not yet, and hopefully won't see images of, you know, overburdened ICUs and hospitals and that sort of thing. But we are, you know, I think one of the things that's happening now, and it's even different from that time, is, you know, it seems to be that younger people are getting sick. And that means that less of them are going to the hospitals. Also, the hospital system and doctors are significantly better today at treating the virus than they were a few months ago. And that's evidenced by the much lower percentage of people that are on ventilators, even though you have a similar hospitalization rate to March and April. So, you know, I think Miamians are, you know, still not 100% in sort of a panic mode. You know, if things continue to get worse, I think we're going to see the kinds of images that we saw in New York. We could see them, and that could certainly increase the anxiety and the fear among our residents.
Mayor Suarez, what is leading to this spike that we're seeing right now? Because we know that a lot of states, including Florida, started reopening a couple of weeks ago. Businesses started reopening and inviting guests in restaurants, for example. Is that part of what happened here? Was it too soon to reopen? And is that what you're witnessing happening as far as this increase in cases?
I'm not sure that it was too soon to reopen. I mean, it's hard to gauge when is the appropriate time to reopen. You know, we looked at the criteria that was established by the White House, which was, you know, what everyone was essentially going by, which was the 2 consecutive weeks of declining cases. We actually had over 30 days of declining cases, and our cases were consistently below 200 per day. Now, obviously, we had 2,000, which is 10 times that amount this week. But I think what happened was when we opened, you know, the behavior of people in opening was just as if COVID didn't exist. And I think that's something that's very hard to control. We tried to message it right. We were the last city in Florida to open. We opened later than the county, which opened the tri-county area, opened later than the rest of the state. So we were extremely careful and cautious in reopening. And I was criticized, by the way, for waiting as long as I did. But the truth is that, you know, it really comes down to behavior. At the end of the day, it depends on what people do. If people listen, if they don't congregate, if they wear masks, if they wear gloves, if they distance themselves and then stay at home when they can, the chances of the disease continuing to grow are little. The problem is this is a highly infectious disease. It's incredibly efficient at spreading. It doesn't require a lot of contact, at least anecdotally from things that I hear from people. I got it. And I, you know, was not in any sort of significant contact that I know of with anyone who was positive. And you know, it may have been, it was, the press secretary of the president. I may have shaken his hand a couple times. You know, we may have been in a close proximity in early March. And that's all it took for me to get it. So, you know, I think it's highly infectious. And, you know, I think people need to act as if everyone who they could encounter in public may have the disease.
Mayor Suarez, you mentioned that you yourself tested positive for COVID-19 back in March. Are you fully recovered?
I am. And, you know, one of the things that's interesting, and you know, there may be examples of this in other parts of the country, but, you know, we have in Florida, I want to say somewhere in the vicinity of 140,000 positive cases. And I asked the Department of Health on Monday, you know, how many of those 140,000 positive cases are double positives? In other words, somebody who has become positive, you know, became negative, and then later on contracted it again. And they told me that so far the number is zero. So that's an interesting statistic, because it will be interesting to see what level of immunity somebody has who has contracted the virus. You know, obviously I donated plasma when I tested negative twice in a row and in 2 consecutive days. And I have tested since then and continue to test negative. So, you know, it'll be interesting to see how that evolves going forward.
We're talking about behavior, Mayor Suarez. And while we can't control what everyone does at all times, you mentioned a lot of the guidelines that have to be implemented in order for people to prevent the spread of COVID-19. Some of those guidelines include wearing masks and continuing to social distance. How are those guidelines being enforced right now in Miami? Are they being enforced? Because at the end of the day, we can ask people to do something, but as we've seen, people are going to do what they want to do unless there is some enforcement mechanism.
Yeah, that's true. And that's very possible. I will say that when we implemented the stay-at-home order, I'd say a vast majority of people actually listened and they were compliant. And we didn't go door to door to make sure people were at home. You know, we implemented last Thursday a mask in public rule. That same day, our city commission passed an emergency ordinance creating a fining system. So if you're caught or if you're, you know, not wearing a mask in public the first time, you get a warning. And actually, we're giving our police officers masks so they can also give them to the people. We don't want to just have a stick approach. We want to be able to give people the masks that they need. And I've been distributing them in the areas where they're the highest incidence by zip code. And then the second instance is a $50 fine, then a $150 fine, then up to a $500 fine. So we are actually, you know, going to be fining people just like you would if you're not wearing your seatbelt, just like you would if you run a red light or run a stop sign. You know what I mean? I mean, people get very worked up about some of these rules. And I tell people, look, this is no different than our government trying to protect you in a variety of different circumstances. And by the way, it's different. And the only thing way that it's different is that it's temporary, as opposed to a seatbelt rule, which is permanent. You know, when you're wearing a seatbelt in a car accident, it doesn't guarantee you're going to survive, but it increases your chances. And so we as a society have decided that everyone needs to wear it. It's the same thing. You know, we want to protect people not only from others, but others from them. The other thing we're doing is with businesses, because we also have seen restaurants that have sort of converted themselves into nightclubs, we are requiring those establishments to comply. Otherwise, they're going to get shut down for 10 days. In a first occurrence, 15 days, in a second occurrence, and 30 days in a third occurrence. So what happens is if a restaurant, if we got a complaint, social media, someone sends us a picture or a video of a restaurant, we go out there. If they're not compliant, we shut them down. The next day, if they comply, if they rearrange their tables, they can reopen. And so now what we're saying is no. You know, we want to associate a penalty with noncompliance, because otherwise people will just not comply and then open the next day. And that just creates more hassle for us, more enforcement for us, and it also sends a wrong message.
Mayor, the Latino population has been especially hard hit by the coronavirus in some cities around the United States. Miami is a majority Latino city. What is being done to protect this group in particular, if anything?
For us, being Latino, being Hispanic, being of a different nationality is the norm, not the exception for us. And what we're doing is, and the only thing we can do, because the Department of Health has limited the information that we receive for HIPAA reasons.
How so, Mayor? How so has the Department of Health limited what information you receive?
Well, for HIPAA reasons, we can't, for example, you know, unfortunately, or we're trying to push them to give us, you know, a little more targeted information. But right now, what we have is we know the zip codes where the highest incidents are. But I'd like to know, I'd love to be able to say, can we get like a heat map based on the contact tracers of where do people feel that they contracted it? We're asking for the occupations of the people who have gotten it to see if there's any patterns. Are they people that work in restaurants? Are they people that work in supermarkets? So we're trying to create correlations between the people that are getting sick and what they do without violating their HIPAA, their privacy. And so that's what we're working with the Department of Health, and we're hoping to get more of that information in the coming days so that we can be more targeted in our response to help people.
Well, speaking of that type of targeting, I wonder if you could speak a little bit about how Governor DeSantis has handled this coronavirus pandemic so far. The governor made some comments blaming, quote, Hispanic farm workers for the rise in cases. Your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I don't think that's good. I don't agree with that. You know, I think, listen, there are a variety of subpopulations that you'll see outbreaks, and that happens. That's normal in a sense in when you have a pandemic. So I wouldn't single out any particular ethnic group or any particular, you know, subpopulation. I think, you know, outbreaks can happen in a variety of different contexts. You know, people who are farm workers are hardworking people who are trying to make a living and trying to provide for their families, like so many others in today's day and age and in this pandemic. And that's really one of the challenges that we have, which is how do we manage the economic impact of COVID-19 with the health impact? And the health impact doesn't interact with the economy. I mean, the COVID, the virus doesn't care what it destroys, who it kills, you know, what aspects of our quality of life it affects. And our economy doesn't understand or relate to the fact that there's a virus out there. And so we have to make sure that we protect people. So it's very, very difficult to mix two things that are basically oil and water and try to continue to keep our society going in a way that doesn't hurt more people.
Mayor, the beaches in Miami, Fort Lauderdale, and Palm Beach will be closed for this upcoming July 4th weekend, but just for the weekend. Would you consider a longer shutdown extension of the beaches?
You know, the beaches are basically controlled by Miami-Dade County and by the mayor of Miami Beach, which are the big sort of tourist beaches. We have a beach, which is a small beach called Virginia Key, and it's also closed. You know, I think anywhere where there are large congregations of people, we have to consider closing them. And we do that, by the way, because we have not entered into phase three. So movie theaters are closed, bars are closed, and they've always been closed. And of course, sports, entertainment facilities and venues like the American Airlines Arena is closed. So anywhere where there's a large congregation of people, we have to seriously consider not having open.
Mayor, when I spoke with you back in 2018 in Miami, we were over at WLRN. Miami was just recovering from Hurricane Irma, and you spoke about resiliency back then. We are now a month into hurricane season. I'm wondering whether Miami is ready for hurricane season on top of a global pandemic. So far, hurricane season has been relatively quiet, but it is, as we know, you can never tell.
I'm knocking on wood. That's what I'm doing there. Yes, it has been relatively quiet, and we hope it stays that way. Certainly, we've dealt with a lot of adverse situations this year, and we're hopeful that Mother Nature doesn't throw another one our way. But Miami has demonstrated over time that we're extremely capable of preparing for storms and megastorms. From an infrastructure perspective, we still have a long way to go, and we're lucky that we have resources. We have a Miami Forever bond that we're going to begin spending down, hopefully in September. But that's a process that's going to take years, and we're hopefully going to be ready from an infrastructure perspective to deal with an Irma-like event, which produced 6 to 8 foot storm surges, where we would struggle, and I think any city in the world would struggle, is with a Dorian-like event, where you have a Category 5 hurricane that sits on top of you for 2 days and produces 18 to 25 foot storm surge. I don't know that there's any place on the planet that's prepared for something like that. And, we've got to continue the process of building our infrastructure so that we can be here, as our sort of branding indicates, that we can be here forever. That's our objective.
And lastly, Mayor, we've been in talking to different people on the show about this moment, which is so difficult for so many people, no matter how you look at it. This is just a really hard time that a lot of us are going through. And so we're asking people what they're doing to find moments of joy. And it could be the smallest thing on a daily basis. If there's something that you are doing to find joy and hope in this moment right now, Mayor Suarez.
I think the biggest thing that's happening in our community is that we are spending more time with our families. Because many of us are working at home, myself included, I'm at home right now. I get to see my kids so much more than I would otherwise. I think also people are spending more time outdoors. You know, when we had stay-at-home orders, you know, the amount of people that were walking, that were biking, that were running, you know, increased tremendously. So I think we're, you know, getting in touch with Mother Nature. We're getting in touch with our families. And I think that's an incredibly positive, uplifting, an inspiring thing in the midst and in the context of these very difficult times.
Francis Suarez is the mayor of Miami. Mayor Suarez, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
The recent uprisings for racial justice have sparked conversations about systemic racism and white supremacy in all parts of our lives, and that includes the classroom. Many Americans are starting to re-examine what they learned in their history textbooks and what was left out. Everything from the 1921 Tulsa race massacre to the legacy of redlining in many U.S. cities. And that's prompted educators to rethink how to teach a more complete history of the United States that includes the experiences of Black and Indigenous people and other communities of color. So today we gathered some history teachers to talk about how their favorite subject is changing. LeGarrette King is a professor of social studies education and the founding director of the Carter Center for K-12 Black History Education at the University of Missouri. LeGarrette, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us are two high school history teachers, Jessica Rucker of E.L. Haynes High School in Washington, D.C., and Matt Bockenfeld of Fishers High School in Fishers, Indiana. Jessica and Matt, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Matt, let's start with you. The school year is over, but before it ended, how are you helping your students make sense of what's happening around them right now?
Yeah, well, it's absolutely a difficult time. And within the context that I teach, it's a majority white school and a majority white community. And so there are some pretty significant challenges that we faced in terms of understanding and the reaction that people had. And so I think that the place that we started in my classroom was just for what I needed to do. We needed to start with just dispelling myths. And so I just I've had lessons in the past where I wrote Dr. King's quote up on the board: "A riot is the language of the unheard," and we processed that together. We talked. I've brought in guest speakers to sort of think through what we're seeing in this nation. And then another piece is that we talk a lot about whiteness in my class because that's the majority of the students that I serve. And white kids need to interrogate how whiteness works, what it does to us. It's a lot of people think that whiteness is a neutral experience, and that is an enormous problem. We can't begin to confront the issues that we're facing right now until we admit that whiteness is not a neutral experience, that it is an active experience that we have.
Jessica, what about you? How are you incorporating talking about some of these very difficult and complicated issues that are happening, including police brutality, with your students?
Yeah, thank you. That's a great question. First, Matt, shout out to you for discussing whiteness. So I teach an Introduction to African American History and Culture course at E.L. Haynes, which is a high school located in Ward 4 of Washington, D.C. I work with Black and brown youth. And we're always talking about race because of the ways that we are raced as individuals. So this particular current moment allowed us to deepen our conversations, and I've identified, and students identify themselves actually as cultural practitioners and custodians of justice. They, like me, understand that deep learning is not simply about classes in schools, but it's about building relationships to break down barriers erected by systems of oppression. So this current moment has created an opportunity for us to revisit different eras that have been thematic in U.S. history. And I describe myself not as a U.S. history teacher, but as an us history teacher, because this is our history, and students happen to be living through another iteration of white supremacy. And we similarly have been reflecting on Dr. King's statement as the patron saint of nonviolence, who even reminded us, that a riot is the language of the unheard. And so one of the things I've been asking students to do is to harness their voices and to remember that their lives and experiences matter, that this is a time of deep grief, but also an opportunity for us to celebrate in our collective joy, because we've resisted these conditions which have existed in this nation for generations, but we're also inspiring a different form of communication. Because for us, nonviolent direct resistance has resulted, no matter the time period, in white supremacist violence towards us. And we're having a conversation now that our lives will no longer be contingent upon convincing enough white people that we actually deserve human rights, if I could borrow from Nicole Hannah Jones. So that's what learning is looking like for us.
LeGarrett, let's break this out for the national, at a national point of view here. There is no national U.S. history teaching curriculum. Is that correct?
No, there's not. And I think when we begin to talk about a national curriculum, we have to be very careful, because sometimes that can backfire based on the story that we're trying to convey to our students and to our society. So historically, many politicians help develop or they vote on the types of curriculum that we will receive in schools. And typically those curriculums are kind of focused on this progressive Eurocentric narrative. And I think throughout the years we have conceded to say, hey, the U.S. has made some progress, or we've made some mistakes, but we've always fixed these mistakes and racism is over, right? So while there's not necessarily a national curriculum, the National Council for the Social Studies does have 10 themes that they recommend for all history classrooms throughout the country.
And Matt, LeGarrett, I'm wondering whether or not there are very specific things that have been left out. I think back to Howard Zinn's A People's History of the United States, which some of us may have read in college, which for many people was the first time they had heard about a lot of the stories that have been left out of our high school and junior high and even elementary school history books. So are there specific things within that you feel deeply concerned about that have been left out of the textbooks?
Right. Well, instead of just pinpointing various different people or events, we have to look at narratives. And most of our narratives do not connect the past to the present. So, of course, when we're talking about systemic racism, we don't talk about the connection between slavery and today's society as the 1619 Project does. We do not name aspects of racism, white supremacy, anti-blackness within our curriculum, and we don't tie those particular situations within throughout our narratives.
Jessica, have you had discussions within your department or with school leadership about making major curricula changes across the board in the upcoming school year, given everything that's happening?
Yes, I have. That's a great question. One of the gifts of working at E.L. Haynes High School is it's a high school that is rooted in leveraging our teaching and learning through a race and equity lens. And recently, actually, I proposed a year-long elective course that will center Black lives and facilitate an E.L. Haynes-specific student-led movement towards transformational justice, healing, Black joy, equity-driven direct action, et cetera, et cetera. But even before proposing this course that I want to teach this fall, I was already teaching an introduction to African American history and culture course. And one of the things I love about our electives department is that we use art to help visualize the problems that we are fighting against, to help us and our students imagine a better future, to amplify messages to a wider audience. And this is work that Haynes has been doing since its inception. And this particular moment, the 2020 uprisings, have allowed us to even push our thinking even further as a school within the electives department and even with some upcoming collaborations with our history department as well.
Matt, you mentioned talking as you're majority white students and you're a white teacher, talking to them about interrogating whiteness and what that means right now. But I'm wondering, what about white colleagues? How are other teachers that you know sort of processing this? And are you actively trying to engage them in this topic?
Yeah, that's a phenomenal question. That's really been the project of this summer. I've begun a book study with about 45 teachers in my building. Almost all of them in the book study are white, and we're asking real hard questions about the ways that we have been complicit in perpetuating injustice, failing to intervene when we needed to, and asking hard questions about our curriculum. When I came to this high school, the first time that Africans really showed up in the world history curriculum was the Middle Passage, the origin of the transatlantic slave trade. To teach history in that way perpetuates white supremacy. And so we've been in a multi-year overhaul of the curriculum to really interrogate our own complicity in the system and to work to be anti-racist within the system.
Speaking of anti-racism, LeGarrette, we've been hearing a lot of talk about that and people saying that it's not enough just to say they're not racist, but to be actively anti-racist, particularly since George Floyd's killing. I'm wondering, LeGarrette, how do you incorporate anti-racism into education? What would an anti-racism curriculum look like?
Well, I think for one way is that we have to totally revamp our U.S. history curriculum. I think a very popular axiom out there is that Black history is U.S. history. And while we understand that sentiment, right, in terms of you cannot tell the story of America without telling the story of Black America, that is a fallacy in the ways in which we practice that, right? Because Black history is not American history in the ways in which we construct it now. So in many ways, what is historically important to white people is not historically important to Black people in the terms of, let's say, July 4th, right? 1776 means exactly nothing, right, to the majority of African Americans who were particularly enslaved during that particular moment. So it's about transforming entry points. It's about transforming, as Matt said, there's implications to teach. To the first time students are introduced to Black people is through enslavement, right? Those are serious implications in the ways in which we understand ourselves. So we first need to totally transform the U.S. History curriculum and find different entry points, different people, understand historical people in very nuanced and different ways. And that starts with the teachers really examining themselves and their identities.
Wondering, Jessica and Matt, I'm curious about your thoughts on how you would advise teachers who may still be relying heavily on textbooks that might be outdated, teachers who are going to have to confront their student, or I wouldn't say confront, but really have to start teaching again pretty soon, whether it's online or in person, and they're going to have to confront these ideas in the classroom. Any tips, Jessica, for how teachers can improve this fall?
Yeah. So first, this country was founded on ideals of white supremacy and capitalism. And so unless we are going to teach the long history of black resistance, the black freedom struggle and white supremacy, I think we're helping to sustain the problems that this current movement is designed to uproot. There are people's historians online, many classes facilitated through the Zen Education Project. Author Jean Theo Harris suggested the series, and they're on Fridays. And I would suggest that teachers get involved, because each of these 75-minute classes also offers breakout rooms for 12 minutes to talk about what participants are learning, to discuss the content, but to also push our pedagogical lens that in a way that it centers the lives of the people who have made this country what it is today, specifically black and brown folks.
Matt, what about you? How do you propose, particularly dealing with folks who may be resistant to some of these ideas coming up in the fall?
You know, I would just tell teachers that you cannot serve your students until you see your students and see yourself. So if you haven't, you know, reflected on your own identity and how whiteness works, it doesn't matter how good your intentions or how big your heart is, you will do harm. And so you just need to begin a process of reflection and growth. The water's warm, like, come on in, we need you in this fight. This has been an age-old, you know, fight for equity and justice and human dignity, but we can't do that without white people. So we really need you to get involved in the fight. And that means read James Baldwin, read Ta-Nehisi Coates, get involved.
And have your students been receptive so far, Matt? We've got just a couple of seconds left.
Yeah, students crave an authentic, genuine confrontation with history. And so when you give them that space, they jump on it.
One of the things that often gets talked about are holidays, particularly when it comes to the school year. So I want to sort of ask a little bit about some of the ways that we can rethink these holidays, particularly in the classroom. Jessica and Matt, we've got July 4th coming up. We just passed the celebration of Juneteenth a couple of weeks ago. There are lots of questions about whether Columbus Day should even exist and or be replaced with Indigenous Peoples Day. How do each of you approach teaching national holidays like this that on the one hand seem pretty harmless, and think when I'm thinking back to when I was a kid and you see Thanksgiving and it's just such a peaceful scene between, you know, the pilgrims and the Indians, and there's so much more to it. So how are each of you approaching these complicated holidays?
Yeah, so first, I grew up in a household where July 4th was not called the 4th of July. It was called the 4th of July. And what my mom wanted me to see that in 1852, when Frederick Douglass gave his speech, which is now popular and famous, which wasn't then, that he was talking about the hypocrisy and this two-ness of the United States. What to the slave is your 4th of July? I mean, it's a reflection of the gross injustices and cruelties that have been visited upon black people. And in terms of teaching about holidays, there's a great book by Teaching for Change, Moving Beyond Heroes and Holidays. And so I tend to take that kind of mentality and approach, and even asking students why certain individuals or groups are commemorated, whether it's through holidays or through memorials, and then really challenging why individuals become like messianic figures in our historical memory. And then to the piece around Indigenous People Day, that's how we honor it. One of the funnest lessons I do with students is we analyze a song, Oceans by Jay-Z. And in that song, he says, the only Christopher we acknowledge is Wallace. I don't even like Washington's in my pocket. And I don't want to waste time analyzing it here, but it speaks for itself. So that's my pedagogical approach to holidays.
Matt, what about you in terms of dealing with some of these more complicated realities that these holidays represent? And even we could even extend this to what's happening, to Jessica's point, with monuments and symbols that we're seeing across the country that are being literally torn down as we speak.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to say that the conversation around holidays like Columbus Day remind me a lot of the conversation around Confederate monuments and statues. The way we memorialize our history matters. This idea that we will forget our history if we don't have you know, Robert E. Lee on horseback, you know, framed in the middle of a city center, it's ridiculous. You don't learn anything from standing in front of a statue and looking at it. You know, we're not at risk of forgetting our past. We are at risk of misremembering our past. And that is what these holidays and these monuments do. They build a mythical past that we don't have to be rooted in. The fact that so many white Americans feel like their identity is threatened by the dismantling of these old systems of power is silly. You know, we can build our identity in something more just than something like the Confederacy or what happened to indigenous people on the land that we're sitting in right now. So I don't have the power to dismantle holidays. So we just talk about it and we try and have just a really honest conversation. Why do we remember this? Why do we not remember this? How is this holiday leading to us misremembering what actually happened?
And LeGarrett, want to round this out with you because I think that I'm thinking of the parallels between how education and history is taught and somehow sometimes how media frames conversations about race by separating them from other conversations, right? And I think that happens often with months like Black History Month or Hispanic, quote unquote, Hispanic Heritage Month, right? Where we set aside time to, in theory, honor cultural icons and understand. But that seems to be it. Like, we're just setting aside these couple of weeks for Black History or Hispanic Heritage. There is no Indigenous Heritage Month, right? So we don't even reflect on that. How should we, or how should educators think about incorporating these histories throughout the year and not just limiting it to one moment in 12 months?
Well, I think the biggest misnomer about Black History Month is that Black History Month is supposed to be the only time in which we celebrate Black history. Now, when Carter G. Woodson developed Negro History Week in 1926, the idea was that that week was the week where we were supposed to reflect and present about all the Black histories we learned throughout the year. Right. So somewhere throughout history, we kind of switched it up a little bit. So February is really the time where we're supposed to reflect about the year long curriculum in which we learned about Black people through the other 11 months. But Black History Month is extremely important, you know, for all different types of reasons and all these other ethnic celebratory months. Because there is a time where we can kind of expand our knowledge that we didn't really have much time throughout the year. But again, just like I mentioned before, it's all about transformation and transforming the curriculum where we not only learn history, we learn histories. And that's a very important, you know, concept where we delve in and begin to explore the multiple histories that make up our country.
And I'm also wondering within those histories or that those history months, LeGarrett, whether or not the figures that we are taught about really represent the complete or a more complete picture of, for example, Black Americans' contributions or Latino contributions to this country. I'm thinking, you know, Black History Month comes around and we hear about Martin Luther King, but are we hearing about the Black Panthers? Are we hearing about other figures in Black history that may be more controversial, if you will, and I'm putting that in big air quotes, than who we usually tend to admire during those months?
Well, the U.S. history curriculum is focused on kind of this Eurocentric narrative. Therefore, despite the fact that we have had an educational policy that looked at the quantitative progress, but not the qualitative progress, and when we add various different Black people to the curriculum, typically those Black people are constructed in a way not to hurt white people's sensibilities, right? To kind of continue this Eurocentric progressive narrative in which we have constructed throughout the curriculum. So yes, we need to explore the diversity of Blackness within Black history, right? Because sometimes when we look at Black history, we see center only black males who are middle class, who had Christian beliefs, who are heterosexual, and who are able-bodied. And we miss out on the intersections of black history, right? Black women, black LGBTQ people, and all these different diverse ways in which black history can be explored. And that there we can really understand the humanity of black people throughout, and is a little bit more complete and nuanced.
Matt Bockenfeld is a history teacher at Fishers High School. Jessica Rucker is a history teacher at E.L. Haynes High School. And LeGarrett King is the founding director of the Carter Center for K-12 Black History Education at the University of Missouri. Thanks to you all for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Carnegie Hall is one of the most famous concert venues in the world.
The first time I walked on the stage, I felt like my feet were moving, but they were not touching the floor.
Join us for If This Hall Could Talk, a new podcast that explores the history of this iconic landmark through the unique items in its archives. I'm your host, Jessica Vosk, and together we'll explore how the past shaped the culture we live in today. Listen to If This Hall Could Talk wherever you get podcasts.
Voice of America is the U.S. government-funded foreign broadcaster created in 1942 that provides news to hundreds of millions of people in 40 languages. But today, VOA and other U.S.-funded media outlets are in a state of chaos. Trump appointee Michael Pack recently took over the U.S. Agency for Global Media, which oversees the outlets, and fired the heads of all the networks and many senior staff. Yesterday, bipartisan Senate leadership issued a letter disapproving of the move and vowing to do a review of the agency's funding. Senators say they fear that the U.S.-funded international media could lose its independence and become a Trump administration propaganda tool, weakening the fight against disinformation abroad. Joining us today is Adam Applebaum, staff writer at The Atlantic and a senior fellow of the Agora Institute at Johns Hopkins University. Welcome back to the show, Anne.
Thank you.
So, Anne, before we get into the specifics of what happened, can you explain exactly how government-funded international media outlets work?
Sure. It's very important to remember that there are different kinds of outlets. On the one hand, there's Voice of America, which transmits news about the United States and tells the opinion of the United States in different languages around the world. On the other hand, there's also a series of networks that used to be radio stations. Now they, of course, broadcast in video and online. Radio Free Europe is the most famous. There's also Radio Free Asia. There are stations that broadcast in the Middle East and in Cuba. And these stations are very important because they are not U.S. government propaganda. And what they do is they, in countries where there is no free media or where the media is threatened, they seek to provide real information and good information. And so people tune into them to hear what's going on in their own countries. VOA has a slightly different status, but it too also seeks as much as possible to act like a real journalistic outlet. So there is a firewall between VOA and the other stations and the U.S. government. They are not directly controlled by the White House or the State Department or by anybody else. And historically, they've all been run by bipartisan boards, so people from both political parties that sought to keep them separate from the government and to keep them kind of journalistically honest. And that, to be honest, was their value. This is why people listen to them. I mean, if they'd just been propaganda outlets like, you know, the Russian government puts out or the Chinese government, then they wouldn't have so many listeners. But in particular, these local stations that use local journalists and broadcast in local languages, sometimes very dangerous places. You know, there's a Uyghur language outlet in which people really risk their lives to work for this station and to get news about what's really happening. And they work hard to get out, you know, accurate, real information. So it's very important, has been considered important historically, that all of these stations have maintained real journalistic credibility.
So, Anne, who's Michael Pack? We know he was appointed by the president and went essentially and removed all the people who were there. So who is he and what's his strategy so far?
Michael Pack is a documentary filmmaker. He's an acquaintance of Steve Bannon, who has been vocally supporting him. He's been kind of hanging around in conservative circles for a long time. He was appointed by Trump 2 years ago to run the U.S. Agency for Global Media, which is the umbrella organization that controls all these VOA and RFE and the other networks. His nomination took a long time to get through the Senate, 2 years, and that's largely because Senate Republicans were very wary of him. They didn't trust him to keep up the, you know, keep the institution, as I said, bipartisan and separate from politics as it has historically been. Finally, Trump pushed them to move forward with his nomination in June, and he came into the stations and immediately did actually much more than people had feared he would do. He not only fired the head of VOA, but the head of all of the stations, including some Republican-appointed CEOs, and he also dissolved the bipartisan board and replaced it with a very, very strange board, which contains mostly mid-level Trump appointees from other agencies, none of whom have any background either in broadcasting or in foreign policy. So it looks like he's just appointed people whom he can control. Nobody really knows why he's done this, whether he now wants to make the stations into kind of Trump, you know, pro-Trump broadcasting agencies, or whether he just wants to do kind of more nationalist broadcasting like the Chinese government does, you know, America First broadcasting. But he's really, really disoriented and disordered the building, and without any, as I say, without so far any clear goal.
And we saw bipartisan Senate leaders issue a letter on Wednesday where they objected to the changes at the U.S. Agency for Global Media. And I mean, there isn't a lot of bipartisan movement in D.C. these days. So what does this tell us?
No, I mean, first of all, it tells us how shocked people were and surprised by what PAC did in his first couple of days in office. Secondly, it reflects the fact that apparently PAC has not been answering phone calls or emails from Congress. He doesn't seem to want it to. He seems to have not taken on board the fact that this is a congressionally funded institution, and at some point he's answerable to Congress. I think it also reflects the fact that Congress acknowledges, and if you talk to Senate staffers, they will, the law that enabled PAC to abolish his board that was passed at the end of the last Congress was badly written, that Congress has somehow taken away the guardrails, has allowed this to happen. And even Republican senators acknowledge that this was a terrible mistake. And I'm assuming that it's a prelude to some change in the law or some attempt to create some oversight for the agency. But, you know, it's a little late. I mean, they should have thought of that before allowing somebody this irresponsible to take over this extremely important job. I mean, I just can't emphasize enough how many people all over the world depend on U.S. technology to get around censorship, depend on real information produced by U.S.-funded journalists and radios and television. You know, this is maybe the most important tool that U.S. foreign policy has in getting through the enormous propaganda, waves of propaganda that is created by authoritarian regimes all over the world.
And we've talked about the importance of these outlets and specifically the technology that has allowed for people to communicate outside of repressive regimes. How else will these changes affect people abroad, for example, thinking about places like Russia?
Well, you know, look, one of the main tasks of these stations, so Russia is reached by a service called Radio Liberty, which has been in operation for decades, and has spent a lot of time, the journalists who work there have spent a lot of time over the last several years thinking about how to fight Russian propaganda, how to counter Russian lies, both inside Russia and around the world. And there is a real danger that this really quite thoughtless attempt to undermine the credibility of these networks will harm that effort. So again, we're talking about Russian propaganda in the region, in Europe, around the world. It may now become easier for whether it's RT, the Russian television station, or Sputnik, the Russian government's website, to get across information. As I said, they've been countered by Radio Free Europe, Radio Free Liberty, Radio Liberty, and that may now, those counters may now weaken. Remember how difficult it is for the U.S. government to get its message across in markets like that. Most people are very cynical, and they'll say, well, okay, our government lies, but, you know, the U.S. government lies, you know, we don't believe anybody. And one of the few ways in which you can reach people is by creating services that have some credibility. So voices that people recognize, sometimes even cultural programs. VOA for decades had a very famous jazz program that 30 million people listen to around the world. Sometimes it's cultural programs. whatever it is that creates credibility and builds trust. This, with literally one set of acts, you know, the Trump administration has very badly damaged that trust. And this could have political significance in all kinds of ways that we haven't even thought of yet.
Could this affect Americans here at home?
Well, one of the questions is, you know, what is PAC trying to do with this? It is actually illegal for these broadcasters to reach Americans. I mean, they were banned from broadcasting in the United States many decades ago. I mean, that's become a little bit more tricky now that they put material out on websites that, of course, Americans can access. And one of the questions is, well, maybe PAC has fired everybody because he intends to use the broadcasters in order to reach Americans, you know, to create some kind of Trump TV, you know, that now that Trump has lately been a little bit, you know, dismayed by Fox News, which doesn't support him 100% all the time, you know, maybe he wants his own propaganda outlet that will reach Americans and help him win the election. I mean, it's a little far-fetched.
And to that point, I mean, doesn't Trump have enough money to create that on his own?
I mean, he could, but why not? You know, this is, we're talking about existing media outlets that have millions and millions of dollars of government funding already, that already exist. You know, you don't have to create them from scratch. And also, by the way, I don't think Trump does have enough money to create his own media outlets, you know, at that scale, certainly not at the moment. You know, as I say, this would be illegal, and it's, you know, it's hard to see how exactly it could be done between now and November. But, you know, again, these are very irresponsible people. They don't seem to know what it is they're doing. I mean, one of the other oddities is that they fired everybody without seeming to have a clear idea exactly who they would put in their place at the various outlets. So, you know, maybe they'll try something.
Anne Applebaum is a staff writer at The Atlantic and a senior fellow of the Agora Institute at Johns Hopkins University. Anne, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
All right, folks, that's it for us today. I'll be back on Monday, and Amy Walter will be here tomorrow. I want to give a quick shout out to the crew that makes this show work each and every week. Debbie Daughtry is our board operator, and she was in the studio all week alongside director and sound designer Jake Howitt. Jose Olivares was our line producer. The show was produced by senior producer Alexandra Botti, along with Ethan Oberman, Jackie Martin, Jason Tureski, Meg Dalton, Lydia McMullen-Laird, and Katarina Barton. Polly Irungu is our digital editor. David Gable is our executive assistant. And our main man in charge is Lee Hill, who hopefully had a nice break this week. It's been great having you all with us. Keep calling us and telling us where you find joy this weekend at 8778-MY-TAKE. Have a great holiday, and I'll talk to you on Monday. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.